Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. CRISPR-Cas9 is the term for a new understanding and ability to manipulate the human genome. The possibility of eradicating disease so that we can all lead our healthiest lives feels imminent to some scientists and commentators. But what about sliding down a slope toward genetic determinism when various traits become more valued than others, height, intelligence, certain eye or hair colors? It's not at all hard to envision a dystopian future where those of us wild type, that is, born without genetic alteration, become alien or undesired. Eugenics had a broad basis in Europe and the United States in the early 20th century. The Nazi Party in Germany adopted many of the underlying assumptions about genetic superiority and began implementing a system that sought to eradicate the weak, vulnerable, or feeble-minded, as they were called. My guest today, Jesse Ulrich, is the new director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. The Federation's Sherwin Miller Museum is currently hosting an exhibit on loan from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. through March 5th. The exhibit is titled Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, and it details the eugenics movement in Weimar Germany and its transformation into the horrific experiments performed on people with disabilities, Roma, and Jews in the Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Jesse Ulrich of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Jesse Ulrich, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just tell us about the exhibit Deadly Medicine at the Sherwin Miller Museum. What is on exhibit there?
So Deadly Medicine is an exhibit it's a traveling exhibit from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. It is an exhibit that specifically talks about how the Nazis played on the ideas of eugenics and science that were around at the time and used that not to better society, but what they thought to better the Nazi race, the German, you know, the Volk. And they did that by systematically killing other people and then medically examining how effective different killing methods were.
One of the things that surprised me the most about the exhibit, because the little history of it that I knew was, of course, I'd say the most notorious of the doctors was like Dr. Josef Mengele, the so-called Angel of Death. And how he, I think, after World War II managed to escape and sort of live out his days in, I want to say, South America, Brazil, or Argentina.
I think it was Argentina.
But one of the things that really haunted me about the exhibit was there was at least a half a dozen different people of different medical professions who the exhibit demonstrated, you know, sort of just went back to their regular life, their academic posts and things. They had conducted some horrific experiments. How did that happen? I mean, why weren't they tried at the Nuremberg trials or things like that, or disbarred from the profession as it might be?
Well, so it was a combination of factors. Mengele is the most famous because of a weird coincidence where he was injured in the, you know, out in the field, not in a hospital, and ended up being taken to Auschwitz to recover. And so while there, he's like, well, I'll do my research here. And since Auschwitz is one of the worst concentration camps, and, you know, was liberated by the Allies, he couldn't hide his evidence of what he was doing. It was clear. The other doctors who were in cities and in research facilities, they, as they saw the Nazi regime collapsing, did what a lot of people try to do. They tried to cover their tracks. They got rid of a lot of their research. They forged death certificates to give people diseases that, you know, they didn't have to cover up their research. And because of the Cold War almost instantaneously starting after World War II, a lot of them who stayed in Germany just sort of transitioned into another field. You know, the Allies were probably more concerned with the generals and the people running the concentration camps than they were the doctors, because they didn't know about that, right? The concentration camps, you know, rumors were coming out and people were reaching out to other people. Even that wasn't confirmed until they liberated those. But what was happening in the research facilities and in the hospitals was a mystery to everyone. No one knew what was happening.
So it just took some almost forensic evaluation and historians to kind of go in after the fact and sort of unearth this stuff. So let's talk for a minute, because I think many of our listeners may not even know this very dark chapter of history. But I mean, of course, everyone knows about World War II and the Nazis and for the most part, the death camps. But in terms of medicine, or deadly medicine, as this exhibit is called, Dr. Mengele, most infamously, I mean, he did twin studies, right, mm-hmm. where he would subject twins who were prisoners in concentration camps to different stimuli or do different operations on them to kind of see how they would turn out. What were some of the other atrocities that were committed under the guise of medical research?
Well, a lot of this medical research was in service to a flawed ideology, a flawed scientific ideology about eugenics and how to breed better people. And so the exhibit does a very good job of sort of walking you through the scientific basis at the time that led to what the Nazis did to better their own race, which was that it didn't start with Jews. It started with the physically and mentally handicapped. And not just the Nazis. In England, in America, there was a movement to cut people out of the gene pool. There's a very famous Supreme Court case, Buck versus Bell, where Oliver Wendell Holmes talks about how three generations of imbeciles is enough. This case, the Supreme Court upheld a law that allowed a state to sterilize people without their consent. They upheld that because they thought it was better for everyone involved if this family was, you know, cut off at the root of its family tree.
And this, of course, went on in Germany too, forced sterilizations, and in euthanasia as well.
Yes.
Of so-called defectives.
Yes, and I try to find the small hopeful chapter in all of these stories. In this particular one, the German people aggressively responded to this euthanasia of infants especially, and so loudly that Hitler had to, he didn't shut it down, but what he did was he quietly moved the program somewhere else to make sure that no one would see it. But they were beginning to test what would become the gas chambers, right? That's how they ended up, you know, murdering these, you know, these children, some of whom had, you know, what today we would call some disabilities, but some who just, you know, were just different. Like, they never gave these children the chance to grow out of something. They were like, this child seems feeble-minded. Now we're going to kill it. The feeble-mindedness gets thrown around a lot in this exhibit. It's not really a term we use anymore, so I don't know how they were defining what was feeble-minded, but these were infants, so I don't know how you tell a smart infant from a feeble-minded infant.
Yeah. You mentioned that this exhibit comes to us in Tulsa from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. How does that work? So that's the museum in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they obviously have a huge archive of many materials from the World War II era and commemorating the Holocaust. This is not the first exhibit that we've had from the Holocaust Memorial, is it?
No. Last year we had State of Deception, which was a exhibit about propaganda. And to give everyone listening a little background, a lot of times big museums, big national, international museums, when they come up with exhibits like this, design them in a way to be traveling exhibits so they're not built in a way where it's too expensive to move them. State of Deception was actually an incredibly heavy exhibit because they had these huge posters that were being held by these like metal bars. Deadly Medicine, on the other hand, is really just like thin pieces of film attached to some Velcro. And so it's designed to be flexible, and it's designed to be easy to ship from one city to another. And usually they have to design that from the very beginning.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jesse Ulrich. He is the new director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations for the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. And we're talking about a new exhibit that is at the Sherwin Miller Museum on the Zero campus, down at 2021 East 71st Street. It's called Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race. Jesse, let's talk for a minute about your role as Director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations. How did that position come about? And I know you've only been in it since September, but what does that exactly entail? Are you working with schools and community groups?
The job is kind of fascinating because it has three different components. There is a museum heavy focus where I'm helping coordinate tours that, you know, from different schools and religious groups that want to come to the museum, helping to make sure that they have docents available to them to show them around. We are part of the Any Given Child program at the Tulsa Public Schools. So every eighth grader in the Tulsa Public Schools comes to our museum and is shown both our permanent Holocaust exhibit and the Jewish art and history exhibit that's upstairs. And Deadly Medicine is in the back of the second floor, which is our traveling exhibit space. So there's that museum component. And then the Jewish Federation of Tulsa has a Holocaust Education Committee that is built up of survivors of the Holocaust, teachers, retired teachers, community leaders. And we sort of help lead Holocaust commemoration events in town. We work with other minority groups on issues that tie us all together. And then the other part of my job is sort of the community relations part. The Jewish community here in Tulsa is not incredibly large. And because we are a very, very small minority, we feel like the best strategy and the smart thing to do, and I can tell you, growing up here, the smart thing to do is learn how to talk to other communities. And so part of my job is to interact with, you know, any programs the OCCJ might be doing.
Oklahoma Center for Community Justice.
Yes, which growing up I remember as the National Center of Christians and Jews, and a good name change on that one, because that's not inclusive enough at this point. We do programs and we work on rallies with, you know, immigrant groups. We do anything. Anytime there is an immigrant population in town that is being troubled by something, we're there. Because if the Holocaust taught us anything, is that it could easily be us next. Also, it's the right thing to do.
You mentioned, I was not aware that every eighth grader in the Tulsa Public Schools comes through the museum. Is that a longstanding program, or how was that set up?
I don't know how old the program is, but it is the way any given child works. It's any given child should have access to art history, to creativity. And so the sixth graders go somewhere, the seventh graders go somewhere, and the eighth graders go somewhere. And because of the nature of our museum, we wanted the kids to be a little bit older for us, but they go to Philbrook, they go to Gilcrease. It's an incredible program because, you know, there's a school bus in our parking lot 3 days out of the week, every week. Some schools, it takes multiple weeks to get through all of them. And we try to teach them the history leading up to the Holocaust and a little bit of the Holocaust, even if they haven't gone to that point yet in their own history classes. And the thing I love the most about our Holocaust exhibit is that it opens with a 1920s KKK robe, a Tulsa KKK robe, where we talk about the Tulsa race riot first, to point out that the Nazis did not have a trademark on hate and on killing their neighbors.
No monopoly on hate. And you also, at the museum as a permanent feature, are some video testimonials from survivors here in Tulsa.
Yes.
And you mentioned the Tulsa survivor community, which, you know, just on the basis of how many years it's been, I know is, you know, and that's true kind of everywhere, that people have been, you know, reaching old age and dying out, those that were fortunate enough to survive. But you also mentioned the committee. So teachers and former teachers and other folks who are interested, I mean, how did that just come about? Through federation, just through a strong desire on the part of the Jewish community to commemorate the Holocaust and remember it so as to not forget?
A little bit of both. The sort of leader of the Holocaust Education Committee, Eva Unterman, who is a survivor, sort of on her own started, someone reached out to her, a teacher at a school, and asked if she would come and talk about it. And from that point on, that network of teachers has been growing and growing. It's really amazing to see, because it surprised me where some of these schools are located, that, you know, where they have teachers who have gone and been trained on teaching the Holocaust and then want to bring their students to the museum and to do a Q&A with Eva from towns I have never heard of. We've had people from cities in the Panhandle. We had someone from a school from Sealing, Oklahoma at the museum yesterday, and I had to look up where Sealing, Oklahoma is. It's almost to the Panhandle. It's far away. These kids got on a bus at 6:30 in the morning to come. You know, it's grown from there, and it's truly amazing. I did not expect this many non-Jewish history teachers to find it so important to teach children about the Holocaust. Because I don't know about you, but I remember my history textbooks, you know, in middle school, the Holocaust maybe got a paragraph in the World War II section, which you never got to anyway. And so it's really surprising now that there's a curriculum out there they can use. There are all these great resources. That was not around when I was growing up.
Jesse, you mentioned that one of your responsibilities as the director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations is there are certain commemorations that the community puts on every year. And I think I read that one of them is for Kristallnacht, which is in November, which commemorates, I'll let you tell us, what does it commemorate?
Our Kristallnacht commemoration is in memory of what in German, if you translate it from the German, would be the Night of Broken Glass. What we as Jews believe was the starting event of the Holocaust, where a state-sanctioned pogrom happened, where, you know, the Nazis and the supporters of the Nazis used their anger and frustration to destroy Jewish property, to scare the Jews of Germany into a sense where they did not know if they were safe anymore. So it was the beginning, where before the Jews of Germany could think that there was this political party that did not like them that much, but it was a democracy and, you know, the right will always win out in those cases. And that was the moment when they realized that was not true. The Jewish historical sort of sense of let's just bunker down and get through this was broken by that.
What are there other sort of annual commemorations? I mean, there is a Holocaust Remembrance Day.
There is. So there's an International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was actually January 27th. And then there's Yom HaShoah commemoration, which is April 9th, which is at least our event's on April 9th. You know, every year we do a interfaith Yom HaShoah commemoration because, again, Jews are instructed to never forget the Holocaust. And I've always taken that as never forget that humanity can be this terrible to itself. And so to look out for others and to make sure that we don't allow, we don't quietly sit by as another group of people is murdered just for being who they are.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jesse Ulrich. He is the Director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. And right now, the Sherwin Miller Museum at the Federation on the Zero Campus at 2021 East 71st Street has an exhibit called Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, that is on loan from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And Jesse, you grew up in Tulsa, right? And you moved back here for this new job. You mentioned before growing up Jewish and learning how to talk to folks of other faiths. How did that come about?
I grew up in Broken Arrow, Broken Arrow having the least Jews of the Tulsa suburbs. And my parents also weren't from here. They moved here from Brooklyn in the 70s.
What led them here?
That's a whole interview in itself.
Okay.
But to summarize the way my dad has always told the story is that he was just tired of New York City. He wanted trees. He wanted to be somewhere else. And by a crazy set of meetings of other people, met someone who ended up going to the University of Oklahoma and like sent him a letter about how great it was out here. And so my dad, who went back to college as an adult, you know, he went to work right after high school, moved him and my mom out to Norman, Oklahoma, where he got a master's in English, where he studied Chaucer and Dante, and then wanted to teach English to people like him, you know, students who were coming back to school as adults, and spent almost 40 years teaching remedial English at the Metro campus of TCC.
Wow.
And TCC was actually so new at the time. It was TJC at the time.
Yeah, Tulsa Junior College.
Yes. He was given a list of schools, and they weren't even listed yet because the book was 5 years old, and TJC was 3 years old at the time. And so I spent a lot of time with downtown as a child before, like, now when it has things to do. It was, you know, there were the churches, there was the Spaghetti Warehouse, and there was TJC, and that was it. So growing up in Broken Arrow, as you can probably tell from my voice, I'm not an introvert. I'm not a quiet person. And so I embraced the fact that I was different from everybody else. And especially in Broken Arrow, it was kind of hard not to. My favorite story is in middle school, my very first day in sixth grade, I'm walking down a hallway and I see three sort of big flyers for student groups. There was Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Fellowship of Christian Male Athletes, and Fellowship of Christian Female Athletes. And my question was, who are these groups for? Like, it's everyone but me. So I sort of embraced that. Like, people obviously had questions. It's a very, you know, this is, people like to call this the buckle of the Bible Belt. There's a lot of interest around Judaism as a religion. And a lot of people I met, I was the first Jew they met. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself to at least have enough knowledge to be able to explain to them why we do this, why we don't do that, why we celebrate Thanksgiving, why we don't celebrate Christmas. I was asked if I celebrate Thanksgiving, and that question always confused me a little bit because it doesn't seem like a religious holiday at all, but, you know, how people view the world was sort of interesting to me. And meeting other religious minorities in the area, whether they be, you know, Catholics or Muslims, it was a bonding experience, really.
And so you, after college, you went to OU, you wound up in Boston.
Yes.
Where you took a master's degree at Brandeis University.
That's correct. Brandeis has about 60% Jewish student population, so very different from Oklahoma. And I thought that number would be higher. I didn't think there'd be 40%. You know, I didn't think there'd be that many non-Jewish students who'd want to go to Brandeis, but they have a very good international business program, apparently. There are many Jewish stereotype jokes you can make about that. But I moved up there in 2005 and stayed there till August 1st of 2017, where, to correct you, I did not move back for this job. I did not have a job when I moved back.
Oh.
I actually came on August 1st specifically for a job interview for a job I was at for 4 days before taking this job, which is a story for another time. But
the siren song of home pulled you back, though.
It did. It did. Boston is an amazing city. but Boston is not my city, and Boston's Jewish community was not my community. You know, it's going to be fine without me. You know, the Tell Us Jewish community was incredibly important to the way I live and the way I treat other people. And I thought I could do better. I could do more here in a community like Tulsa, which is big, but not too big, right? It's not big enough where you make one difference and it doesn't really matter because it gets rolled over by the hundreds of thousands of other people who are here. You know, Tulsa is a big, small city in that sense. I also missed, you know, the gridded streets and censored left turn lights. So if you want to know what drives people from Oklahoma crazy in the Northeast, it's the fact that left-hand turns are not protected ever, and it's chaos.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
It is dangerous.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, of course, about Boston is you can kind of feel like you're going straight, and you wind up going in a circle sometimes.
You do. Yeah. You do. And the street you were on changes names for some reason, and then you're going the opposite direction, and now you're in a different town. It was amazing to be able to drive to another state in like 45 minutes. Because, you know, growing up in Tulsa, like, it takes you at least 3 hours to get to any other state. But things are so compact there, especially Boston. Boston is not that big, square mileage-wise. And, you know, the difference between my apartment and my work there was like 4.5 miles. Here, I'm like 15 miles away. I still get to this job a lot quicker than I did my old job.
One other question I want to ask you about your role with the Federation. So it may not be fair to ask you this at this point because you're still very new in the role. But I mean, what are your visions for, you know, how you might grow the programs or take it in a new direction? I mean, it's more like an interview question, a job interview question, but also I guess a radio interview question.
Well, I'm taking this job on in a very interesting time where, as you mentioned earlier, the number of Holocaust survivors is quickly dwindling. And it's always been an open question of what is Holocaust education and Holocaust commemoration like when there are no more survivors left? Who will speak for the silent, right? At that point, they'll all be silent. There are second and third generation survivors, you know, children of survivors and grandchildren of survivors who continue to tell the story, to educate. But that's something the Jewish community has to prepare for because the lesson's still there, the lesson of protecting those who can't protect themselves and speaking out for those who are not being listened to is a universal issue. So I would say that's a challenge that's ahead of me in this position. And especially with, I would say, the political fever being what it currently is, there's never been a better time to just sit down and talk to someone as a person instead of as a set of political beliefs. And if growing up here taught me anything, is that people are separate from their political beliefs. And you shouldn't use that to judge or to, you know, preconceive how someone's going to react in a situation or what they're like as an individual person.
Jesse, I want to ask you one more question about the exhibit. We started talking about Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, which is an exhibit from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington that's on loan to us here in Tulsa at the Sherwin Miller Museum. And, you know, you mentioned this about eugenics, and that was really kind of the underlying pseudoscientific basis for a lot of the Nazi experiments. But you also mentioned that eugenics was a forceful movement in Great Britain and as well as in the United States in the 20s and 30s. The exhibit doesn't really comment, I mean, because it's a historical exhibit, but I was curious if you had thought through, because I know actually you're teaching a course this semester, if you will. It's really just 6 weeks at the Adult Institute for Jewish Studies. There's this new technology, CRISPR-Cas9, that really allows us to manipulate genes. And there are many commentators who have suggested that we may be on the cusp of a new eugenics movement, right? Because, I mean, to the good, we can use technology like CRISPR-Cas9 to try to alleviate or mitigate diseases or genetic mutations that cause people to suffer. But of course, it's a slippery slope, we think, to you know, designer babies and picking gender and eye color and stature and all these types of things. So in your preparing for the course that you're teaching, I mean, did you come across that, or are you focusing mostly on the historical?
Oh, no, I've come across that because the questions are all still the same, right? The desires are all still the same. And the slippery slope always starts when you get to the point where the people in power get to decide what is a desired trait versus what is a non-desired trait. You know, when does it go from trying to make the best version of what you think you're trying to make? You know, in the eugenics case, you know, Nazi Germany was trying to make the best Nazis, right? The people in Great Britain were trying to make the best British people. And, you know, the American sterilization movement was about not letting the worst Americans continue to breed. But who is deciding that? You know, the same questions we're facing in Myron Gen X are the same questions that should have stopped the eugenicists of the early 20th century, which was that, who are you to decide what someone's supposed to look like, what their, you know, what their genetics means, what their genetics are actually going to become when the person becomes a person, right? Because eugenics is all about, it's all about genes, right? There's no natural selection. There's no nature versus nurture argument. It's all nature to them, right? Whatever's in their genes, that's what they're going to be. And what my class is spending a lot of time on is getting people to the point where they understand that at this moment, they thought this was the peak of science, right? We can make better people. And that the question they didn't ask themselves was, should they, right? Eugenics instantly becomes a tool of nationalism, anti-Semitism, and racism. One can only hope that we try to avoid that the second time around, right? Because who gets to decide what a person gets to be, right? You know, the example I always like to use is that my dad is 5'11 and my mom is 5 foot, right? I'm 5'6. I am exactly the middle of the two of them. That's not, my sister isn't 5'6. She's 5 feet, right? So when do we get to decide how tall people get to be? When does it stop, right? Like, yes, can we filter out diseases that might kill somebody? We should definitely do that, right? Something we all agree on as a community. It's when we start fighting over what we can and cannot do is when we should all stop and be like, okay, maybe this is the line. The community has decided, no, we're not going to make everyone the same, you know, give everyone the same hair color or eye color or, you know, athletic ability.
Well, the name of the exhibit is Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, on loan from the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and it is on exhibit through March 5th at the Sherwin Miller Museum at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa Camp, the Zero Campus, 2021 East 71st Street. And we were speaking about it with Jesse Ulrich, who is the new Director of Holocaust Education and Community Relations for the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. Jesse Ulrich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.